If you think of the future, the fuel will be universal. Sun and wind is universal. No? What will be the strategic threats?
Welcome to the Smart Energy International podcast, your guide to innovation and trends in the global power and energy sectors.
Hello and good day. I'm your host, Claire Bulkvane. In today's episode, I'm trying to find the answer to a question. How can the energy sector balance the competing priorities of addressing the immediate challenges related to COVID-19 and take drastic steps against climate change? This question isn't something that's come out of nowhere, but the answer is the focus to the latest World Energy Markets Observatory, Capgemini's annual thought leadership and research report that tracks the transformation of energy markets around the world. In order to find an answer, I'm joined by Philippe Vier.
I am Philippe Vier, and I am leading Capgemini Energy Utilities and Chemicals sector for our group.
And Colette Louiner.
Hello, I'm Colette Louiner. I am now Senior Energy Advisor to Capgemini Chair.
Philippe, Colette, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you, Claire.
Thank you, Claire.
Philippe, I'm going to start with you, if I may, and ask, what is WEMO, as it is more commonly known, and why is this a report that the industry should be paying attention to?
Of course, Claire, and thank you for this question. WEMO, the World Energy Market Observatory, this is this year our 22nd edition, is surveying through trusted data sources what is happening on electricity and gas market on all dimensions, the regional dimension, meaning the North America, Europe, Asia, including India and China, which are so important for our industry, but also Australia, and on many topics, climate change, energy transition, the technology progresses, everything about the security of supply, both for electricity and gas. And this year we have a grid stability in it, the retail markets, the finance of the players, the regulations, and the transformation strategies. Everything in one single document organized by region and by topics.
Thanks very much, Philippe. As you know, I look forward to receiving the report every year, and I'm particularly interested to hear what is different this year in comparison to previously. So, Colette, maybe you could talk about what for you are the highlights of the report.
Thank you, Claire. I must say, since 22 years, and I launched this 22 years ago, we have really an exceptional period and an exceptional report. Why is it exceptional? Because this period is really composed by two totally different periods. 2019, which was, with some improvements, I would say, the continuation of the past, and 2020, with the pandemic we know and the lockdown that was associated to that, a totally different period. I would like to comment a little bit on 2020. On one side, this period gave us some insight in the future. Why? Because first, the work from distance increased suddenly, and the digitization of companies also. So we gained on this in this sector perhaps 2-3 years. We did now what we were supposed to do 2-3 years later. On the grids, for example, because of the lower demand during the lockdown, and because of, in Europe, the nice weather, wind, solar, etc., we had a very high share of renewables, up to 60% in UK and Germany, and this posed very big problems to the grid. We had a near blackout in UK because I could not export this extra electricity. They had to pay for dispatchable generation to stop, like nuclear plants, for example. And it demonstrated in a certain way that the grids are not ready. Now, on another side, certain projects were not able to go quickly through because, of course, during the lockdown, all construction stopped more or less. So we will see on the renewable side probably less capacity installed in 2020 than what would have happened normally. On the third point, And this is a little bit troubling, a little bit confusing perhaps. We had, because of the lockdown, we had a very important decrease in the greenhouse emissions. It decreased by around 20% during the lockdown, and the forecast for this year is it would decrease perhaps by 8%. Now, we should not take this for granted, because we still need to make efforts towards the climate change. We would need a lockdown similar to the spring lockdown each year for 10 years to get on track on the Paris Agreement objectives. This is not thinkable. We don't want it as well. So meaning that we have to continue efforts on climate change issues. And to conclude, I would say there could have been different decisions on, let's say, the European level, the countries level, even the companies. Perhaps this pandemic would have stopped the efforts on climate change. And it is the contrary that happened. And you can see now a big commitment on climate change issues. For example, Europe has voted a $750 billion stimulus plan, out of which 30% has to go to green projects. So this is also very, very important.
Colette, thanks very much. You've raised one or two points that I would like to come back to a little bit later. But I think what I would like to ask, Philippe, is if you could perhaps just share for you what the highlights of the reports have been.
Colette clearly stated where we are in terms of climate change and what were the main impacts and learning from the pandemic and notably the lockdown period. What struck me also when we have worked on the report is the fact that the technologies, the sector technologies are continuing to make big progress. We have seen a decrease of cost in the renewables. We have seen progress in storage technology, notably the batteries, with an important concern on the fact that or most of these technologies are relying on Chinese suppliers on one side or on Chinese rare earths and rare metals provided by this country on the other side. We have seen also, thanks to the pandemic, something which is not new, but the acceleration of hydrogen as a new energy carrier. We have seen also the reactions of the players, meaning trying to reshape and rethink their strategy and their new value proposition on the market. And these are the most important facts that the report brings this year.
Philippe, while you and I are talking about this, perhaps you could expand a little bit on some of the issues of grid stability and security of supply that came up in this year's report.
Yes, absolutely, Claire. As already mentioned by Colette Leviner earlier, the share of renewables in the energy mix has been higher, notably during the lockdown period because of the decrease of the consumption on one side and on the priority given in most of the Western countries to the energy coming from renewables. And this has been to a level which would have been expected between 2025 and 2030. And it had an impact with the share of renewables in average 40, 45, up to 50%, and some days and in some countries up to 60-70% on the instability and the load demand balance, which was not assured in some countries. It happened in China, it happened in Mexico, it happened in California, it happened in UK, it happened in Germany. And the situation are always different from one country or one electric system to another. Let's take the European example for the moment. So UK, when we had more than 60% of renewables, it was very difficult to really get the related demand because the UK is not interconnected as much to the other countries. In Germany, it was possible to serve, notably France, where the nuclear reactors were stopped because of the social distancing and of the maintenance which was operated. In California, the situation is quite different. California has nothing to do with the pandemic. In California, it was during the summer, hot summer, and the California imports 30% of its electricity consumption from the neighboring states, which were unable to help because at the same time, the hot temperature was also recorded in these neighboring states. And as California is provided every day by 30% of solar electricity, when there is no more sun in the evening, this is the moment where the peak of demand is the highest because of the cooling systems. So these facts endanger the grid stability. It was the case also in China, and notably in the western part of China, for example, in Mongolia, where there is a lot of wind farms and where the grid are very poor and are unable to bring this electricity provided in this region to other regions. So to manage this, Chinese have taken strong action to curtail the renewables production. It went up to 17% in 2016 and decreased to 6 to 7% today because they have improved their grids and notably expanded their supergrid. They have put obligations on producers to better balance and predict their generation and to store the additional energy. There is finally a bunch of solutions to meet the grid stability. First of all, growing new lines, reinforce existing ones, and finally, implement smart grid at scale, which is today possible because the digital technology have matured. Of course, the better security of supply is also directly linked to keeping enough schedulable generation, decarbonized schedulable generation like nuclear plants, but also when it's not possible, gas plants. To improve the intermittent generation predictability, to grow storage centralized at utility scale level or decentralized storage when the EV market will have be growing enough. And finally, what are the Californian ISO doing also, system operator? They are growing and growing demand side management, which is also something that we should do in Europe. To make this, we should evolve the regulation, notably on distribution tariffs that are compensating the infrastructure investment, the copper investment, the hardware investment, and that are not compensating enough today, the digital investment, the fiber. And tomorrow, the smart grid at scale will be less copper and more fiber to manage the grid. For that, the electric system operators and the transmission system operators, which are managing this balance at high level, should be also helped by the distribution system operator that should participate in the management of the local balance and leveraging more the data because most of the renewable farms are connected today to the distribution grid operators.
Philippe, thank you very much. I think that was a really comprehensive outlook of what is happening around the world. And, you know, I'm particularly interested in how different parts of the world are adapting to some of the demand and stability issues. Colette, if I may, I'd like to perhaps just shift to what the role of hydrogen is going to be in the future.
Thank you, Claire. I think it's a very timely question. Hydrogen is not a new subject, but what's new today is our hopes to produce green hydrogen at a competitive cost. Green hydrogen is, as you know, hydrogen produced with water, with electrolysis of water, and using green electricity. And it is a fact that today the green electricity, renewables electricity costs are going dramatically down, that gives hopes again that green hydrogen could be produced at competitive cost. What's done today, it's what's called gray hydrogen. It's starting with either natural gas, methane, or coal, and it is used widely in the industry. But this process is emitting huge amounts of greenhouse gases. In between, you have what's called blue hydrogen, which is gray hydrogen, but if using what's called CCUS, carbon capture, usage, and storage, to just abate, if you want, the greenhouse gases emissions. So what are the challenges for green hydrogen? First, I would say the cost. Cost is a real challenge. It is more or less three times more expensive than gray hydrogen. So to replace it and to make this huge savings on greenhouse gases, it has to be at similar cost. Huh? The second thing is to do that, you need to improve technology. This is clear. And notably, electrolysis technology. Today, there are mainly two technologies, alkaline electrolysis, which are very mature, and what's called PEM electrolysis, which are better adapted to renewables in the sense that those electrolyzers can stop and go when you have a lot of wind or sun and the cost is low, or when you don't have and you stop. So this technology has also to grow and become mature. Now, to do this, you need to have green electricity. And there are very, very ambitious plans for Europe, for example. The plans are to reach by 2030, 40 gigawatts of electrolysis, while today we are perhaps around one or two maximum. Huh? So it's very ambitious. To feed that, you need to have enough green electricity, which is not totally obvious, even with the development of renewables that we see. So probably you will need to keep nuclear or to build new nuclear, which doesn't emit CO2. And also there are projects by which you would use renewable solar, for example, in very sunny countries like North Africa, and bring hydrogen to Europe. So just to say, this is also a challenge. Now, what can we do with this green hydrogen? First, of course, to use it in industry, notably steel, chemicals, to use it in certain cases in transportation. And we believe that it would be adapted to heavy transportations like lorries or boats, for example, and also to use it for electricity storage. Electricity storage is needed because you have to balance at each time, each moment, the demand and production. And you cannot store electricity easily. Today, we store it in pump hydro, but in Europe, the sites to do pump hydro are more or less all equipped. Of course, battery storage is becoming competitive, but you can store it for a few hours, not more. So to have massive storage of electricity, hydrogen is well adapted. And then you can release electricity also on the grid. So these are the three main usages, I would say. I was saying that you have a lot of funding. Europe will fund a hydrogen plan in a very massive way. It's around 300 billion euros from now to 2040. Mm-hmm. Countries like France have a plan of 7 billion euros. Germany has 9 billion euros, so very, very significant figures. This will probably boost the industry, push private enterprise to do electrolysis at scale, big scale, and this will push the prices and the cost down. You have also many players in that. Of course, you have the traditional hydrogen producers player like Air Liquide, for example, in France. You have utilities, you have oil and gas companies, and you have also equipment manufacturers, of course. So we can see a big picture for that. Logistics, I didn't cover that one. You can today put around 6 to 10% hydrogen in normal gas pipelines, not more. And it could also pose problems. The steel used for those pipelines is perhaps porous for hydrogen molecules that are very small. So you can have leaks.
So probably you will need to have dedicated logistic, dedicated pipelines. And there has been an alliance between 11 TSOs to or refurbish or to build around 23,000 kilometers of hydrogen pipes in Europe. So it's quite big. What has to be said also that it will compete with other technologies like batteries, for example, for transportation. Perhaps batteries at the end of the day will be more competitive for lorries than hydrogen. And I think also that Europe and Western world is not the only regions to have hydrogen plants. Since a long time, Japan has been a leader in hydrogen, and China has decided 2 years ago to launch a hydrogen plant. So hopefully, I say that because I'm French, huh? So hopefully Europe will be able to catch up and be a leader. And this is important for sovereignty reasons. We have already, I would say, lost the battle in PV solar cells. We have probably lost the battle in batteries as well. So let's win the battery in hydrogen.
I am very pleased to hear the progress that has been made in terms of hydrogen. I have had over the years many conversations with people about hydrogen fuel cells, and it's always just felt like the impetus to get that technology refined has never really been there. And I think that dynamic has completely changed over the course of the last 2 years, maybe.
Yeah, I would say 2 years. There was a meeting of industry ministers of the G7, I think it was 2018, where they started really to commit to hydrogen. And that was held in Japan. It's not by chance that it was done when it was held in Japan, because Japan was for years a proponent of hydrogen.
That's actually funny. I remember one of my colleagues coming back from Japan that year and talking about the big role that they believed that hydrogen would be playing. And in fact, I think we covered it in the Smart Energy International magazine. Now I'm going to have to go and look for that article. While I have your attention, if I may, there've been quite a number of proposed actions in the WEMO. And one of the outcomes, or one of the things that was highlighted in the report, is that if we don't take fairly urgent action, while we may meet our 2020-2025 targets, we are not going to meet 2030 or later. So of the actions that are proposed in the WEMO, how would you anticipate that we would prioritize both the regional and national actions in order to cohesively move toward a better goal or a better opportunity to meet those goals?
I think that first you need the right economic signals. We talk for years on a carbon price. In Europe, you know, Claire, there is ETS system, which gives a carbon price. Unfortunately, I would say we are all only thinking of carbon emitting in Europe and not thinking of carbon imported when you import goods that have been manufactured by, I would say, not clean electricity or clean energies. So other regions, some regions have those carbon markets, but many don't have. So I think regions that are resisting against that should think twice. Then I would say technologies. There are technologies improvement. Philippe and myself, we said it, cost of renewables going down, cost of batteries going down, hopefully cost of green hydrogen. We should accelerate that. And I think you have two types of technologies here. You have the sector-specific technologies, those that I've quoted here. And now you have more general technologies like digitization, big data, artificial intelligence, etc. And I believe we should apply this even more to meet those challenges. So we have to work not only decreasing fuel cell costs, which we have to do, of course, but we need to also cross those two types of technology and make the two together work better. I would say policies, of course. Policies have encouraged a lot in Europe and in certain states in the US and now in China, renewables. So it has to continue. And I think personally that it has to continue not only for renewables, but for all sorts of non-greenhouse gases emitting technologies like nuclear, for example.
And to finish on this sort of panorama, I would say also education. Education is very important. People not only have to intellectually agree with climate change, but to do it in everyday life. And this is a question of education, and I think education is very, very important. In the edition of the Wim Hof last year, I concluded my editorial to say, saying we're not going to meet the climate change objective if we don't change our behaviors. I didn't know that there would be the lockdown and that we would have to change our behavior, but it demonstrated that changing the behaviors is putting us on the right track, of course, in a very harsh way, and we don't want to continue like that. So I would say education and people behavior is also a very important point.
Philippe, obviously, you know, Colette and I have spoken about the importance of cost. We've spoken about investment, but if we could look at the financial side of things from a little bit of a different perspective, and that's from the perspective of utility companies. So, I mean, we've seen obviously reduced demand, which means less money coming in, but there's also been an increase in non-payment of bills. How do you think this is going to impact the longer sort of transformational plans that utilities have? But also, how is it going to affect day-to-day operations?
First of all, if not all, almost all the players have launched cost-cutting programs to reduce their CapEx needs and their OPEX level. But it's not the only way. They have to cope with the new normal, which is more unstable, which has a lot of volatility. The players need to be agile, but they need also to reconsider completely what they are doing. In last year edition of the WIMO, we have observed that all the players were looking for growth. Growth in terms of geographical footprint, growth in terms of new revenue streams. This is probably not the case today. They have to reconsider their way to meet energy transition priorities, to get access to the recovery packages funds, to meet with decentralization, and also to be very careful because oil and gas players are coming in the utility market, most of them pushed by the diversification imperative, which is coming from the oil prices. So they have to rethink their strategy, they have to rotate their portfolio of assets, and notably with the stranded assets, the black assets, if I may, which are not profitable anymore. They have to cope with weak signals on investments thanks to the crisis. And will they continue to push on energy services? I'm not sure, because of the social distancing, because of these energy services, which were the Graal in the past, are not really profitable today. The demonstration has not been achieved. And with the increased pressure on digitization, this is something that they have to rebalance and to rethink. So the portfolio of the new things that the players are doing are totally different. And we have seen all the players revisiting their priorities. For that, they have levers to consider. The first lever is innovation with the maturation and the progress of the technologies and where their innovation engines. Second lever is digital data platforms, artificial intelligence, robotic process automation, which brings a lot of opportunities which have been under-considered today. Third, they need to secure the fact that the new things they will propose to the market will be profitable and short-term profitable, if I may. And for that, there is a concern they should address. This is their ability to scale up their demonstration, because inventing something, proving in a small minimum viable product exercise that these things are interesting, has been done many times. But scaling up to invade the market and to be leading the competition on this innovation is far more difficult. And we will see in the next years who will be the champions.
Colette, that actually brings me very nicely to my second to last question, and that is, what is the likely impact on M&As across the board going to be for the next 12 to 24 months?
I'm going to build on what Philippe said on the change of strategy of the different players. First, M&As will be triggered by opportunistic cases, for example, distressed companies that want to sell part of their assets. It could be a good deal for other companies that all have a better financial situation. So also utilities mainly and oil and gas companies are trying to divest. And if you divest, meaning that someone would probably acquire the asset. I would say also the change of strategy. They are exiting of services, some of them at least. Also, technology is invading the service sector, and you need probably less, you will need less human intervention in that. So this is a big M&A. Yeah? Mm-hmm. The new strategies pushes everyone towards climate change objective, meaning more renewables, and you see acquisition. We saw over the past years, acquisition of wind farms, of solar farms. You see investments of utility in charging stations, as well as oil and gas companies are doing that. Investment in batteries, and now investment in hydrogen. Let's not forget that there are players like Chinese players still want to conquer new territories. And I would not be surprised to see more acquisition of Chinese companies, at least in Europe, over the years to come. So a complex landscape of M&As. During pandemic, a lot of things were stopped. Teams were not working together. It made it more difficult, for example, to visit the assets. So I think also during the end of 2020 and probably 2021, we should see a significant increase in M&As in the energy sector.
I think not only are we looking forward to increased M&As, I don't know about the two of you, but I'm certainly looking forward to just a little bit of extra human contact as we go out of 2020 and into 2021. I wanted to just end on this one question, and it's for both of you. So Colette, I will let you speak first, ladies first, and that is really, what is the most important takeaway or takeaways that you would like to highlight from the report?
One of the most important takeaways is this shift to climate change consciousness and to renewables, as we said, battery storage, hydrogen. This is a big shift, and we see, thanks to technologies notably, costs are going down. I just want to push things a bit more in the future. Today, or let's say yesterday, we had geopolitical tensions around oil, and still we have them on gas in Europe, for example, because those resources were located in very specific areas like Middle East for oil, for example. If you think of the future, the fuel will be universal. Sun and wind is universal, no? What will be the strategic threats? And I believe, what will be the fuel of the future, if you want? And I believe it is technology, it is research and development, and it is education. And usually Asia countries have put more focus on that than in Europe. India, for example, China, we forgot that a little bit here. And I think we should revigorate that. This will make us successful in the future.
That was very profound, and I think is a message that everybody does need to pay attention to. Philippe, from your perspective.
It's very difficult to come after Colette, Claire, because Colette covered almost everything and we are fully aligned on the messaging. For me, I will insist on the technologies again, sector technologies as mentioned by Colette, but also digital technologies, data is the new oil. Mm-hmm. And all the economies, all the players should consider it, and notably in our sector. And the ones who will be able to integrate all these ingredients, the priority on energy transition, the progress on core technology, sector technologies, and the combination with digital technologies that will rethink their strategy and be leading the new competition on a completely transformed market, even if we are going back one day on the previous level of consumption, but the world will not be the same for our industry, definitely.
I am going to say thank you to both of you for a truly interesting discussion. I've so thoroughly enjoyed speaking to both of you and hearing your views. Every time I learn more and I'm more impressed with the depth of the research that has gone into this year's WEMO. So thank you so much for your time.
Thank you so much.
Thank you for joining us on the Smart Energy International podcast. This episode is brought to you in partnership with Capgemini. You can download the full WEMO report at capgemini.com/WEMO. And we will include a link in the description, both to the report and to the recent webinar that we held with Capgemini. For more podcasts, you can visit the Smart Energy International website, smart-energy.com. Be sure to tune in again soon for more conversations and insights into the things that really matter to our industry. Until next time, I'm Clare Volkveen, and you've been listening to the Smart Energy International podcast.